I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're spending today talking about the legacy of the 1968 riots. We're focusing on Baltimore. Later, we'll discuss the city's struggle to recover with former Mayor Kurt Schmoak. He was elected nearly 20 years after the 1968 riots. He was the city's first elected African-American mayor. But first, we're going to meet with a man who was at the eye of the storm in 1968. Mayor Tommy D'Alessandro III had been mayor of Baltimore for only 4 months when the rioting broke out. When the rioting ended, he and the rest of the city were left to pick up the pieces. I talked with Mayor D'Alessandro earlier today. I started by asking him how he found out about the death of Martin Luther King Jr.
Well, I was at a banquet, I think, at the Alcazar in downtown Baltimore when one of the police aides came and told me that Martin Luther King had been assassinated.
And you knew him?
Yes, I knew him. I had the opportunity of spending a whole day with him here in Baltimore when I was city council president. Can I tell that story?
Please do.
Well, there was a black colonel in the Baltimore City Police Department by the name of Box Harris. He was the highest ranking black officer at that time. He gave me a call and he said he has a request for me. He says, what's that? He says he's in charge of the security for Martin Luther King, who was in the city for that day. And then a couple of minutes before that, Martin Luther King had asked Box Harris if he knew me, Tommy D'Alessandro, who was then I was then the president of the city council. And he said, yes. He said, well, you try to contact him. I'd like to meet him, and I want to talk to him. So Box Harris called me, and he made this request. I said, are you kidding me? Martin Luther King wants to talk to me. He wants to meet me. He said, that's right. I said, well, does he want to come to the city hall? He said, no fanfare. He says, I'll pick you up in about 15 minutes. And then I went to the Lord Baltimore Hotel where he had an entourage and he had his rooms and he took me into his suite, took me into his parlor. It was just him and I, a long couch. He sat at one end of the couch, I sat at the other. And we spoke for about an hour. All of it concerned itself with the civil rights bill that was pending in the City Council of Baltimore. He was well-versed and well-briefed on it and was asking me a ton of questions and some intricate questions about the wordage in the bill and back and forth for about an hour.
Do you remember what your impressions of him were?
Well, I tell you what, he was very, very kind to me. He was a very kind man. He was no pretense about him. He was just a regular guy. You could tell that you were in the presence of somebody who was extra special.
So do you remember what went through your mind when you found out that he had been killed?
Well, first of all, I was with him at a banquet for the evening. So we got together on a more friendlier basis. And so when I got the news, a little curl like went through my stomach. I felt like a body blow. I felt hurt that I lost a real friend. And then I realized that I had a tremendous responsibility for the aftermath, what may happen, because by the time I got the news, which was about 15 minutes after the assassination, some of the cities in the nation were already up in flame.
In fact, this happened on a Thursday night. And Baltimore actually remained peaceful for a time.
We had no problem. We had no problem on Thursday night. We had no problem all day Friday.
At that point, did you think that you might escape any difficulties altogether?
Well, I had all the activist groups or all the groups, city agencies that had contact with the public. I had them acting as antennas. All the police department, the informers, all the civic active groups, the community action agency, the fire departments, the different locations throughout the city. We were just trying to search around to find out if there were any rumblings, any discontent, any concern that we may have, and contacted the ministerial alliances and the churches going into Friday.
Going into Friday, and then Saturday night is when things started to happen.
Well, Friday, right after Friday was completed, I had made arrangements to meet with Governor Agnew down at Annapolis. At that time, I had the police commissioner and some of my staff give a report to the governor of what we found. We found absolutely nothing. Everything was calm. But I did say to the governor, I said, Governor, it's too calm. I was just very apprehensive. I was afraid it was too calm. But that was Saturday morning, and things were still good. I went to the city hall, and then about 1:30 or 2 o'clock, we got some information that some pamphlets, brochures, were being distributed along Gay Street, saying, in effect, close your store in respect to Martin Luther King. And the inference was, or else. So we rushed police in that area, and things were still relatively calm until 5:30 that night. At 5:30 that night, a brick was thrown through one of the stores on Gay Street, and the riot started.
What do you think, and recognizing that a lot of times people have different points of view about this, but what do you think race relations, if I can use that term, were like before the riots? How do you remember it?
Well, I can only say this, that I was the president of the Supervisors of Elections for 6 years. I was a member and president for 6 years, so I had an in-depth knowledge of the power structure of the black community, the people that I had to deal with, the Afro-American, the NAACP, the Urban League, the Ministerial Alliance, and all the black activist groups. So in my involvement with them, being invited to some of their functions, I realized that I was the only white person in the audience. There were no black, there were no whites other than myself. And then when I would go to a white function, the banquets in the white part of the city, there'd be about 1,000 people there, maybe 3 or 4 would be black. There was absolutely no communication between the races, none whatsoever. It was a segregated city. It was a southern city.
Finally, sir, you know, politics is sort of a family business. Your father served in Congress. Your father is also a former mayor of Baltimore. Your sister is currently serving as Speaker of the House of Representatives. She's the first woman to serve in that role. When you think back on it, I wonder, were there things that political leadership could have done differently to have a different outcome back then?
Well, I don't say this braggadociously, but I don't believe there was any white man in Baltimore that knew more about the black community than I did. I lived in it politically for about almost 15 years as far as the supervisors of elections, opening up voter registration throughout the black community, the civil rights bill that we passed, and the first one south of the Mason-Dixon line. We had a manifestation of concern in the neighborhood, mayor stations, the community action agency under the charge of former Congressman Perrin Mitchell. At that time, he was my head of the community action agency. We were rolling. We were doing good. We thought we were in great shape, and notwithstanding all that, we still wasn't strong enough to stop the riots. I don't think there was anything anybody could do to stop it.
Tommy D'Alessandro III was the mayor of Baltimore during the 1968 riots. He was kind enough to join us from member station WYPR in Baltimore. Mr. Mayor, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Now we're going to hear from another historic leader of Baltimore. Kurt Schmoke became Baltimore's first elected African-American mayor in 1988. He served 3 terms. Today, he is dean of Howard University's School of Law. He joins us by phone from his office here in Washington. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, Dean Schmoke, we've been asking our listeners and other guests in the program to tell us where they were and how they heard that Martin Luther King Jr. had been killed. I'd like to ask you that question.
Well, I was away at college at the time. I was actually, just as an aside, I was listening to Mayor D'Alessandro, and he was mayor when I was in high school, and I agreed with him. I thought that he was a very sensitive person, understood problems in the community, and spoke at my high school often, so it was a real inspiration to me. But I was away at college in April of 1968, and that's when I heard the news and decided that I would come home when a riot broke out in Baltimore. And I came on the bus, and I got to the bus station in Baltimore early in the morning, and they wouldn't let any of us out. It was things were locked down. So by the time I got to Baltimore, we had, you know, troops in the street, tanks rolling around. It was quite a surreal scene. And only later that morning did they let us out so that we could go to our homes.
Do you remember what effect that had on you?
Oh, it was quite a shock. I mean, it looked like something from, a movie. It was just totally unreal, although I had seen scenes of that nature in other cities, you know, in previous years. It had the, you know, riots in Los Angeles, riots in Detroit, New York in 64. I mean, there were a number of places that you watched on the news, but, you know, never thought it could happen in our city.
I was going to ask you that because people often see scenes like this happening in other places, and they think to themselves, not here. I wanted to ask, did you feel that way? This couldn't happen in my city.
You know, although we're 40 miles below the Mason-Dixon line, you know, Baltimore is often referred to as an up-south rather than a down-south city. There's kind of a sense of civility and everybody trying to get along, even though we were an incredibly segregated a city, at least residentially. But you know, for example, in our high schools, Baltimore immediately integrated its schools right after the Brown decision in 1955, didn't wait, didn't drag its feet. So there was a sense that we were kind of making progress, even though, as Mayor D'Alessandro described, people weren't interacting except in the schools on a kind of day-to-day basis. But so that's why it came as a shock. There had been no evidence in the early 60s, late 50s of this kind of potentiality in Baltimore.
Part of the rage that sparked the riots was connected, I think many people would agree, to lack of opportunity for African Americans to fully participate in the life of the city. When you were elected, do you think that people invested a very great deal in that moment? In a way, do you feel there was pressure for you that you could never really fulfill?
Well, the city, you know, because of the riots in 68, had been scarred. I like to say it had been scarred both physically and psychologically. And we were, by 1988, you know, when I was in my first year in office, we were recovering in many ways, both the physical side with the birth of, you know, rebirth of the downtown area and Harbor Place and things of that nature, and so that the physical side was looking better. The psychological side was still a work in progress, and so there was kind of a yearning from people for a new leadership that was going to deliver a new opportunity. So in some parts of the African-American community, the expectations were overinflated. Others simply had reasonable expectations, but definitely wanted me to deliver some opportunities that they had seen foreclosed in the past.
We took a tour of some of the affected areas of Baltimore last week and drove around for hours and saw just blocks and blocks of homes that were boarded up, sometimes maybe only one or two houses on the street on the street occupied. Why is that so many years later it's still that way?
Some of it related to the 1968 and some related to another modern-day menace, and that's lead paint poisoning in older homes. But the going back to 68, one of the psychological scars was a fear that, a real sense of fear between whites and blacks. And 1968 led to an amazing flight of whites out of the city, and then followed by middle class African Americans. And so although Baltimore had been losing population between 1950 and 1968, this flight became dramatic in the years about 68 to 1980, somewhere in there. I mean, it was very significant. And thus you had a lot of abandonment of property. So private people would hold on to it, wouldn't fix it up. It just kept deteriorating. Then people would try to move into it and find lead paint problems, and you'd have to get people out of there. So most of those homes that are in the blocks that you're talking about are owned by private owners. They own three or four, not whole blocks. You know, you don't have major slumlords owning hundreds and hundreds of properties, but it's people holding on to property waiting for the city to come in and buy it up. The city has, so you can see in Baltimore kind of a tale of two cities. If you go to the downtown and around the stadiums, walk four or five blocks, you see some of the best in urban America. You walk another five or six blocks away from that area, you see some of the worst. in urban America, and that's been the challenge for mayors over the last few decades.
Briefly, Dean Schmoke, and you've been very generous with your time, what do you think needs to happen now to address fully the legacy of the 68 riots, to really help cities like Baltimore recover? Is there anything that can be done?
The most important thing that could happen, single most important thing that could happen, would be an excellence in public education. If we had, if excellence was the rule in all of our schools and not the exception, you would see more families interacting together. You'd see residential integration rather than segregation. You'd see an investment in the city by middle class as well as what currently occupies our school system, which is two-thirds very poor people. So excellent public education, more than anything else, would be the catalyst for major development in that city.
And very briefly, how is that to be achieved, since you're already struggling to hold on to your tax base?
Well, no, that's it would require a combination of investment by local, state, and federal government. I mean, forget about testing people for No Child Left Behind. You got to invest in folks in early childhood education. But that would be the key. One thing that could be done is for the three levels of government to invest in public education, and that would bring about a real turnaround.
Kurt Schmoke served as the mayor of Baltimore City for 12 years, from 1987 to 1999. He is now dean of Howard University's School of Law. He was kind enough to join us by phone from his office in Washington. Dean Schmoke, thank you so much for speaking with us. Coming up, the voices of those who were there. They witnessed and survived the 68 riots.
I was delivering a baby at Provident on Division Street, and all of a sudden we heard this noise. And we looked down the street, and there were buildings on fire. And the next block, this massive fire.
An oral history project preserves the memories of 1968. That's next on Tell Me More. Michelle Martin, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News.